All right, so today we're going to dive into this pretty wild legal case. It involves, a medical device manufacturer, Guidant LLC, and basically their whole back and forth with the FDA about, those implantable cardioverter defibrillators, those ICDs, the ones that shock your heart back to normal rhythm if things go wrong.
Yeah, those are pretty crucial little devices.
Yeah, exactly. And this whole thing is super interesting because, get this, a huge $296 million plea deal was actually rejected by the court. And these guys, Guidant, they had even pled guilty, but the court still said, nope, not good enough.
Yeah, you don't see that every day. I mean, that much money on the line and they still walked away. Makes you wonder what was missing, right? Like, what did the court think was so important that it just tanked the whole deal?
That's exactly what we're here to figure out today. So our mission for this deep dive, is to figure out why this happened, what was missing from that agreement that was so important. And we're going to focus on two specific devices, the Ventec Prism 2DRR and the Contact Renewal ICDs. We really want to unpack all the ins and outs of holding these big corporations accountable, especially when you've got all these regulations involved. And then there's the whole restitution thing, like how do you even begin to make things right in cases like this? And of course, the court, like what role do they play in all this? It's way more than just rubber stamping these agreements.
Totally. So to really grasp why the court did what it did, we need to walk through everything that happened step by step, like a timeline of what went down.
Right, like how this whole thing unfolded. Okay, so rewind back to 2002. Guidant finds out about this potential short-circuiting problem with their Ventec Prism 2DR devices. They do end up fixing it that same year in November.
Here's where things get a little messy. In August of the next year, 2003, they tell the FDA that this fix they put in place,
Right.
it didn't really change anything about the device's safety or how well it works.
And those criminal charges are basically saying that, well, that report to the FDA, maybe it wasn't exactly the whole truth.
Yeah, that seems to be the heart of the issue.
Okay, so fast forward a bit to mid-2004, and guess what? Similar short-circuiting issue, but this time it's popping up in a couple of models of their contact renewal ICDs.
Right, so Guidant, they put out a product update in March 2005, telling doctors to look out for a warning screen that might show up for patients. However, and this is a big however, they missed that 10-day window to formally report this whole thing to the FDA as an official product correction.
And when you step back and think about it, over 20,000 of these devices were implanted between late 2002 and June 2005. So we're not just talking about paperwork here. It's about actual people, their lives, their well-being. It's serious stuff.
Absolutely. The stakes are very real in cases like this. But just to be super clear, the criminal charges weren't about the initial manufacturing defects themselves. This whole legal case, it really zeroed in on those alleged reporting failures. That report they sent to the FDA about the Prism and that whole late notification about the renewal. And this distinction is going to be super important as we really dig into what the court was thinking.
Okay, so let's get into the legal nitty-gritty here. What specific laws and regulations were they accused of breaking? Like, what rules did they allegedly not follow?
So the big one here is the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. We call it the FDCA for short. And within that act, there's this section 21 USC, section 331, that basically lays out all the requirements for companies to report adverse events related to medical devices. So basically, they have to keep the FDA in the loop about any potential safety issues. It's the law.
And that 10-day reporting rule you mentioned earlier, that's also part of the FDCA, right? Specifically for the contact renewal situation.
Exactly. The rules are crystal clear. If you're a manufacturer and you make any kind of correction to a medical device that could, really affect how safe or effective it is, you've got 10 days to tell the FDA. No ifs, ands, or buts. And when it comes to that August 2003 report about the Prism fix, giving false statements to the FDA, that's also a no-no under the FDCA, and it usually means they're looking at misdemeanor charges.
Okay, so we've got the rules they supposedly broke, but what about the people who actually got these devices, the patients? How does the law deal with any potential harm they might have suffered in a case like this? Like, how do you even measure that?
Right. So that's where the Crime Victims' Rights Act, the CVRA, comes in.
Yeah.
Specifically, 18 USC, Section 37721(2). This act gives victims certain rights, and one of those rights is restitution. But the CVRA is very specific. Restitution can only be ordered if the victim was directly and proximately harmed as a result of the actual federal crime.
Okay, directly and proximately harmed. That sounds like lawyer speak to me. Can you break that down for us regular folks? What does that really mean?
Think of it like a super strict cause and effect. The harm the victim suffered has to be directly because of the specific criminal act that the defendant was convicted of. And that's where what we talked about earlier about the charges being specifically for reporting failures and not the defects themselves, that becomes super important. It means the restitution has to be directly tied to those reporting failures. No ifs, ands, or buts.
Got it. So how did the court actually look at this whole restitution thing in the Guidon case? It sounds like that was a major sticking point for them.
It was the crux of the matter, really. The court did a two-step analysis. First, they looked only at what Guidon actually admitted to doing in their guilty plea. So that was the false report about the prism fix and the late report about the renewal correction,
yeah.
Those two things. And then step two, they looked at the chain of causation. But they could only consider what was directly linked to those two admitted offenses. That was it.
Okay, so what did the court decide based on that very specific analysis?
Ultimately, they said no to restitution. They basically said that no patient could definitively prove that the problem with their device was a direct result of that unreported prism fix back in 2002, as opposed to the original defect that was there before the fix. They just couldn't make that direct connection with 100% certainty.
Okay, that makes sense from a legal perspective, but it feels kind of, I don't know, like it misses the point a little. Like, what about the potential harm to all those people who got those devices? It makes you wonder if the law is being too narrow-minded here, don't you think?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. It definitely highlights a tension that comes up a lot in these kinds of cases. And to make matters even more complicated, the court also pointed out that with those contact renewal devices, Guidon did actually issue warnings to doctors in March 2005, which is before they were even officially required to report it as a correction to the FDA. So that further muddied the waters when it came to linking the reporting failure to any harm that happened to those patients.
Okay, so it sounds like the court was looking at causation under a microscope. Like it had to be a perfectly straight line. But were there any arguments made for a broader interpretation of how those reporting failures could have caused harm? Like maybe a more realistic view of the situation?
Oh, absolutely. In other cases, you know, lawyers have argued for a more, you know, expansive contributing factor standard.
Yeah.
The idea there is that if the violation played some role in the harm, even if it wasn't the only cause, then it should be enough to justify restitution. It doesn't have to be the only cause, just a cause. But in the Guidon case, the court stuck to that very strict but-for test. They were laser focused on those specific reporting actions. So it really shows you, you know, as a listener, that there could be a real gap in how the law handles harm in these types of regulatory cases. It's not perfect.
Yeah, food for thought, for sure. So we know restitution was a big hurdle, but as we said at the beginning, the court rejected the whole plea deal, not just the restitution part. So what else did they have a problem with? What didn't they like about the agreement?
So yeah, lack of restitution was definitely a factor, but the court had a whole laundry list of concerns about this plea deal. Like it wasn't just one thing, it was a bunch of things. For one, they didn't like that there was no probation requirement, which they thought was super important to make sure Guidon would actually follow the rules in the future. And then there were other issues with accountability and oversight that really bothered them. Like they wanted to see more concrete steps taken to prevent this kind of thing from happening again.
So what specific things raised red flags for the court? Like what exactly did they want to see?
Well, for starters, there was no requirement for Guidon to do any community service. And the court specifically called out another case, one with Boston Scientific, where community service was part of their plea deal. So it seemed like they were using that as a benchmark, and the Guidon deal just didn't measure up. Then there was the whole issue of the SDA. The agreement didn't lay out any clear plan for how Guidon would work with the FDA going forward to make sure they were actually complying with all the regulations. I mean, you're talking about medical devices here, things that directly impact public health, so that oversight is pretty crucial.
That makes sense. You'd think they'd want to see some kind of system in place to make sure things are being done right going forward.
Exactly. And then there was this whole mystery surrounding the $296 million payment. Like,
yeah.
Was it a fine? Was it Guidon giving up some of their profits? Was any of it going to be used to make devices safer? The agreement was really vague on that point. It didn't really specify how the money would be used. And the court was basically like, okay, this is a lot of money. But what does it actually mean? Like, how does it actually address the problem and make sure it doesn't happen again?
It sounds like they wanted more than just a big payout. They wanted to see real change, real action, and some kind of guarantee that patient safety would be a top priority going forward.
You got it. And maybe the biggest thing that influenced the court's decision was Guidon's history. They had already settled another case back in 2007 for $92 million. That one was about Medicaid fraud. So that was a huge red flag for the court. They were looking for some kind of, you know, proof that Guidon had learned their lesson and would change their behavior. but they didn't see that in this plea deal. It looked like a big fine without any real commitment to doing things differently.
This case really highlights the challenges of holding these big corporations accountable, especially when you're dealing with something as important as medical devices. It's not easy.
It's really complicated, and it brings up a lot of important questions, like we were talking about before, the limits of restitution in these regulatory cases.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the harm isn't always a direct, you know, slam dunk consequence of some paperwork violation. And it really shows how important the role of the court is. They're not just there to sign off on whatever agreement the prosecution and defense come up with. They have the power to reject a plea deal, even if everyone else agrees to it, if they think it's not in the best interest of justice. That's in the rules, you know, Rule 11C1A of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. They have a lot of power to make sure things are done right.
Yeah, and it shows that tension between keeping the public safe and healthy and the reality of going after these huge companies. It's a balancing act for sure.
No doubt about it. And we can't forget about the ethical side of things either. You know, when it comes to medical devices that could potentially save someone's life, should the courts be able to consider the potential harm that could happen, even if it doesn't fit neatly into that strict but-for causation rule? We've seen other cases where medical groups have filed briefs arguing for a wider definition of what a victim is in these situations. It really makes you think about what the end goal of all this legal stuff should be. You know, what are we really trying to achieve here?
Yeah, and it challenges that whole idea that a big fine is enough to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. It sounds like the Department of Justice might sometimes lean towards that approach, but in this case, the court was really pushing for something more. They wanted to see probation, community service, solid compliance programs, you know, things that would actually prevent these issues from happening again. It seems like they believed those measures would be more effective than just throwing money at the problem.
Exactly. They were sending a clear message. Money isn't always the answer, especially when you've got a company with a history of messing up. They wanted to see real action, real change, and a genuine commitment to doing things by the book from now on. It's about more than just dollars and cents. It's about accountability, responsibility, and rebuilding public trust.
So as we wrap up this deep dive, what are the big takeaways for our listeners? What should they keep in mind after listening to all of this?
Well, first and foremost, it's really important to understand the difference between product liability issues and regulatory violations. Just because a product is defective doesn't automatically mean someone's entitled to restitution under the Crime Victims' Rights Act, especially if the charges are all about reporting failures. It's more complicated than that. Second, that whole idea of proximate cause in these white-collar crime cases, especially when it comes to regulations, it can be pretty narrow. You need a clear and direct link between the specific violation and the harm that's being claimed. And finally, when courts are deciding what kind of punishment is appropriate for these big companies, especially those in industries that directly impact public health, they're going to look at way more than just fines. They'll consider the company's track record, their past actions, and how what they did might affect public trust. It's a big picture view.
It definitely gives us a lot to think about, you know, how we hold these corporations accountable. So here's a final thought for our listeners to chew on. How do we balance the need to punish corporations for breaking the rules with the even bigger goal of keeping people safe and making sure the public trusts the medical device industry? Are the laws we have now enough, or do we need new approaches, new safeguards, maybe something more than just fines and the way we currently interpret restitution under the CVRA? It's a tough question with no easy answers, and that's what makes this stuff so interesting, right? Anyway, thanks for taking this deep dive with us. We'll see you next time.
Always a pleasure.